other websites, which is fakebuddhaquotes.com. And fakebuddhaquotes.com. I've had a couple of people go, "What?" and assume that I make up fake Buddha quotes, but I don't make up fake Buddha quotes. I leave that to other people. I find them floating around in Facebook. All these sayings with the Buddha at the end of them. And as someone who has spent a lot of time steeped in the Buddha scriptures, I hear these things and I think the Buddha could not have said that. So I do a little bit of exploration, and if I can, I find out where they came from and say a little bit about what the Buddha did actually say, or at least what's in the scriptures. But that was last night's conversation. And I apologize. It's hard to hear, okay? Why don't I move closer to the microphone? Or I could move the microphone closer to me. How's that? Is that better? All right. I tend to be rather quietly spoken, so it's a cultural thing. You just turned up the volume?
Yeah.
So maybe I should... leave it where it was. Okay, yeah, I'm from the east coast of Scotland. And we tend to be shy and retiring. Unlike people from the west coast of Scotland, who are more like New Yorkers. Okay. So I'm going to be introducing you to a meditation practice which you probably aren't familiar with because it's not too well known. It's a practical exploration of non-self. It's an experiential exploration of non-self. And my hope whenever I'm teaching, but especially when I'm teaching this practice, is that you'll get enlightened. So I just want to set a goal for today. Let's not, cling to that goal. Have it more as an aspiration than an expectation. But, be open. Who knows? At the very least, I hope we'll make a little bit of progress in the direction of realization. Or maybe even just have or that progress could consist of having a clearer idea of what it is that we're actually moving toward. So this practice that I'll be introducing you to, it's not the only meditation practice we'll be doing today, we'll be doing a number of them. It's called the Six Element Practice, and it's found in the early Buddhist teachings. In particular, if you're familiar at all with the Buddhist scriptures, there's five categories of the discourses, and there's one collection called the Middle Length Sayings. And the 142nd Sutta, as they're known in that collection, is known as the Dhatu Vibhanga, or the Exposition on the Elements. And it's quite a beautiful practice on looking at what we're made of and where it comes from and where it's going to. It can be very beautiful. It can really remind us of our connectedness with the world. It's kind of like meditation meets science documentary. And I'm a bit of a science geek, so that's one of the reasons that I love this practice. Even people who've been steeped in insight practice for a long time often haven't heard of this particular practice. It's just, for some reason, not particularly well known. It is an insight practice, though. It's an insight practice because what it's doing is it's questioning the deep underlying assumptions we make about who we are and what our experience is like. It's investigating the impermanent and insubstantial nature of who we are. It's basically a reflection, as I said, on non-self. And what happens in this practice is that a number of things happen in this practice, but one thing that happens is we expand our sense of who we are. We kind of look at that boundary between, you know, here's me and here's the world. And it's quite natural to assume, because you look down at your body and you see this form, you know, and it looks separate from the world. But Einstein talked about us having about our sense of separateness being an optical delusion of consciousness. And really this sense of separateness that we have arises from the limitations of our senses. Because when I look at myself, it does look separate. I can kind of see an edge between me and where the world starts. But what we'll be doing is looking more closely at that edge and what's inside and how it got to be inside. I first learned this practice quite a while ago, 1993, on a four-month meditation on Spain, very much living amongst the elements. We were living in little unheated huts. We ate outdoors. We meditated in the meditation hall, but it didn't have any... We had window openings, but there was no glass, so the breezes were blowing through all the time. It was very much a beautiful place to be exploring the elements. And I fell in love with it, and I've been doing it quite regularly since then. I love teaching it. Before we explore this practice, though, it can be a little challenging to examine who we are, you know, to question our assumptions of who we are. We can end up, a little alarmed. Sometimes that can happen, is that people get a little bit kind of, you know, worried about, what's happening when we're losing our sense of certainty of who we are. Because, you know, in life we're always clinging to self-definitions of one thing or another. I mean, we identify ourselves, someone says, well, who are you? And you immediately start talking about your name and, you know, what you do and what your family is. And those things become part of our sense of security, you know. And, when people lose their job, it can just be enormously threatening. When your family situation changes, that time, for example, when, you know, your children leave home and you don't have this strong sense of being a parent anymore, something that's been, you know, a very definite part of your life, that kind of thing can be quite challenging. And when we start looking at, you know, the actual constituent parts of, you know, what make us up, and really questioning who we are on that level, that can be a little threatening. So, well, actually, I'm going to add one more thing. Yeah, it can also be beautiful and exhilarating as well, and liberating, as sometimes changes in our lives can be. Sometimes letting go of a definition can be the most wonderful thing that we do. So I don't want to set you up for thinking that this is going to be something really scary that we're going to be doing. It probably won't be at all. It might be quite beautiful. It might be quite inspiring. But it's good to have a strong basis of a positive emotion for entering this kind of practice. It's good to have a strong sense of loving kindness, or just kindness. So what we're going to do is a period of loving kindness practice, which I'll guide you through. So how many people here are familiar with... This isn't a table, is it? My glasses are quite narrow. I have problems looking at my notes because... thank you. That would be fantastic. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, now I can see my notes perfectly. Sorry. So I'll ask again, since I distracted myself. How many people here are familiar with loving kindness practice? Oh, almost everyone is. That's good. These days, I tend to talk about metta, not as loving kindness. I use that word because people then know what I'm talking about. But I'm more likely to talk about it as being kindness. Because I think the word kindness perfectly embodies what metta is. And I find the word loving kindness just a little bit too abstract. It's not a word that we use in everyday experience. You can think of what it's like to experience kindness from somebody else. What's it like to be with a kind person? What's it like when you feel kind? You know, those are things that we can connect with quite strongly. And yet the word loving kindness, this is not a natural part of our vocabulary. It's difficult to fit it into sentences. You know, I had a strong experience of loving kindness, yes, but I met somebody and they exuded loving kindness or they showed me loving kindness. We're not likely to use those kind of expressions in our lives, I think. So I tend to talk more about kindness. And these days when I'm teaching the metta bhavana practice, I tend to have a particular approach, which is to emphasize empathizing with ourselves, first of all. So what I'm going to do in each of the stages of this loving kindness practice is drop in a couple of reflections that can help awaken a sense of empathy. So let's set ourselves up to sit. So first of all, just arriving. Just being with our experience as it is right now. Just allowing everything to be as it is. So this itself is something that we should recognize as an act of kindness. We're being kind to ourselves by accepting who we are right now. So it doesn't matter if your mind is busy or quiet, whether you're feeling happy or unhappy, or whether you've no idea what you're feeling right now. Just accepting as best we can what's arising in this moment. So I'm going to suggest two reflections for you. These are things that you can check out in your experience. Check out in your experience of this moment and comparing this with your previous experiences and memory. And the first of these reflections that we're going to test out is, I want to be happy. Now, it may not be happiness exactly for you. It may be more a sense of peace. I want a sense of peace. Or it might be well-being. I want to have a sense of well-being. So just checking out right now. Is that something that ideally you would like to see in your life? And if you're not sure, check that out with your memories of previous experiences. Think of times you've been unhappy, stressed, or depressed, or anxious. Did you want to be free from those states? Did you want some kind of happiness or peace or well-being? Perhaps you could remember times that you felt happy. Is that the kind of experience that you would like to have more often? And perhaps to have more accessible in your life? So I think we all have some desire like that as a very deep part of our being. And what we're doing is empathizing with ourselves, getting in touch right now with that natural, very human, very wholesome desire for some kind of positive state. And the second reflection is this. It's not easy to be happy. It's not easy to feel at peace. It's not easy to have a sense of well-being. It's not an easy thing to be a human being. So we're just empathizing right now with the fact that it's not an easy thing, this being human. Happiness doesn't arise as often as we would like. Suffering arises much more often than we would like. And this isn't our fault, this is just the human condition. It's just how things are. And so now, having recognized that we're doing a very difficult thing in being human, empathizing with that, we can use the kind of phrases that we drop in metta practice and loving kindness practice to show ourselves support and encouragement and kindness as we do this difficult thing of being human. May I be well. May I be happy. May I be kind to myself and others. And now you can call to mind just one other person that you know. It could be someone you have a warm, friendly connection with. It could be someone you have difficulty with. It could be somebody you don't have any strong feelings about. And you can just imagine that you're with that person right now as a kind of an invisible presence. Just seeing what they're doing right at this moment. What they might be doing. And recollecting that this person, just like you, wants to be happy or to be at peace or to have a sense of well-being. This is their deepest rooted desire. Their most fundamental drive. It probably, one way or another, gives rise to everything they do in their lives. And just recognizing also that for this person, life isn't easy. Happiness, peace, well-being are all elusive. They're hard to find. They're often fleeting, unstable experiences. And this is just part of the human condition. This person too, just like yourself, is doing this difficult thing of being human. So recognizing that we're all in it together, all facing the same basic human dilemma. Let's experience solidarity with them. And express that solidarity through giving them support and encouragement. May you be well. May you be happy. May you be kind to yourself and others as we all do this difficult thing of being human. And now, it's becoming aware that there's a field of awareness. There's a field of awareness that permeates your body and fills the space around you. And within that external field of awareness, there are living beings. You're surrounded by other people. There are other people upstairs and downstairs and in neighboring buildings, operating machinery, walking past. So just take on board that each of those beings wants to be happy and finds happiness elusive. They're all doing this difficult thing of being human. A Scottish theologian said, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle." So as we recognize that, we allow ourselves to have an attitude of kindness, of empathy, of support. Our field of awareness can be a field of kindness, so that whoever we encounter, we treat them with respect for their desire to have well-being and peace and happiness. And recognizing that desire, we would do nothing to obstruct their happiness. And we'd do what we could to help them be happy. And this field of happiness includes yourself as well. This field of kindness includes yourself as well. So we can switch to a we. May we be well. May we be happy. May we be kind to ourselves and others as we do this difficult thing of being human. Just sending that support and encouragement out to all beings within your field of awareness. So with your awareness as a field of kindness, whoever enters your awareness through the door of the mind will be received in kindness. So you can call to mind people who are not here, people you know who are elsewhere, or you can simply call to mind other places and the people who are there. Just allowing yourself to feel kindness and empathy and support. So just letting the mind rest in a kindly awareness of ourselves and others. We don't bring this practice to a close. All we do is bring it into the world. So when you feel ready, you can allow the body to move mindfully, slowly. easing away any tensions that might have built up through sitting still. And then you can let the eyes open. So just see if you can keep that perspective. We're all fighting a hard battle. So I'm not really doing a metta workshop today, but I wondered if anyone had any questions before we go on. Yes. Oh, were you just scratching your ear? Okay. Ah, there's a lady there with a question.
Hi, it's just a little question. What was the second reflection? The first one was, I want to be happy somehow.
Yeah, and yeah. So the first one is, the first reflection is just connecting with that desire that we all have to be happy, and you know, letting that be part of our awareness so that we're empathizing with ourselves. And the other reflection is that it's not easy to do that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Passing the baton.
Thank you for that. It's really beautiful. There's a lot of, it seems like, around the talk of metta as a collective Dharma Sangha in around the US, I suppose, and also listening to others and Tibetan teachers in Theravada, it seems like there's so much more emphasis on metta after 40 years that we've been practicing here in the West, kind of. And I don't know if you heard of John Peacock's about using metta as a liberative practice combined with vipassana. Because that's my main practice, actually.
Right.
There's nothing, I've tried many different methods of mindfulness. Inside, I tried Zen for all those years. I did Goenka for many 5 years when nothing else was around, really. And nothing really transformed my practice as metta has in terms of connecting the body, mind, emotion, and being fully present. So. I'm wondering if you had any insights or advice about using metta combined with a vipassana, because I don't think I could do vipassana without a metta practice.
No, I'm really glad to hear what you're saying. Yeah, actually, it fits very, very much with.
I'm so happy you started with metta.
Okay. What I already have in my notes in front of me relates to what you're saying, so I'll be saying something about that anyway. But I just wanted to drop something in about the goal of Buddhist practice, the goal of awakening. And I think there's a tendency these days to see awakening purely in terms of having some kind of insight, you know, that the awakened being is someone who has had, you know, an insight into, you know, the emptiness of the self, for example. And that is completely true. But if you look at the kind of the ideal person that the Buddha talked about, it wasn't just somebody who had had a cognitive insight. It was somebody who had deeply transformed themselves in many ways. And it's like they're a part, it was someone who was trained, someone who had trained themselves to be kind, someone who had trained themselves to base their interactions with other people on compassion, someone who had trained themselves to be you know, very patient, for example. So it's not just a question of, or the goal is not just a question of, you know, making some kind of cognitive leap. It's about being a very ethical, very loving person who has also had that insight which supports those practices. So yeah, it does concern me a little bit when I see, you know, the goal of awakening reduced to this kind of cognitive trick. And I think it can be kind of damaging for people, actually. There's increasing interest in some of the unpleasant experiences that people have in meditation, and I don't know for sure, you know, what causes them. John and I were talking this morning about Willie B. Britton at Brown University, who's a meditation teacher. And
who's that?
Willie B. Britton. Willoughby. Yeah. And she started this project that she originally called the Dark Knight Project, but it has a different name now. And she was very interested in the fact that some people have very difficult, painful kind of, you know, breakdowns while meditating. And I don't know for sure, but I would be very surprised if the people who are having those kind of breakdowns had a strong background in metta practice. I suspect that it's the kind of thing that happens to people when they have that cognitive insight or get close to an insight into the emptiness of the self, but they don't have the confidence, they don't have the positivity to be able to deal with that. I may be wrong. Yeah. So that actually, what was another question? Yeah. I think there's a microphone on the way.
Good. I was particularly struck this morning during the meditation by the barriers, some of them subtle and some of them very obvious, toward loving myself.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to see if you could, you know, address that issue, because I think a lot of people probably have it to one extent.
Yeah. Well, the reason I teach the metta practice in this way is because I think it helps us to empathize with ourselves. I think one of the reasons that we have difficulty with having kindness towards ourselves is because we don't empathize. I mean, we think, for example, that we just should be able to get on with life. We should be okay. We should be happy. And it's quite obvious sometimes when we do that to other people that we're not being compassionate. You know, when someone comes to you with a problem and you say, well, all you need to do is this. You know, and what they're really looking for is like a human connection, and you're not giving them a human connection. It's like you're giving them an instruction manual. And we do that kind of thing with ourselves as well. So I emphasize self-empathy as a basis for developing self-metta. And another thing I was talking about last night, which has been interesting me, is that there's a passage where the Buddha is talking about people who don't like themselves, or people who say they don't like themselves. And he says, well, and I'm paraphrasing here, he says, okay, so you get people who say, you know, we don't like ourselves, we're not kind to ourselves. But if you look at what they're actually doing, a lot of the time they are actually being kind to themselves. So yeah, they may beat themselves up, you know, psychologically criticize themselves too much. But at the same time, they're doing a lot of kind things for themselves. They are feeding themselves, not just feeding themselves, but they're feeding themselves their favorite foods. Yeah, making sure they've always got them on stock, you know. On a very basic level, you know, we walk along the street and we don't walk into, you know, telephone poles or utility poles or other people, or we don't, you know, walk into traffic. We're careful. We entertain ourselves. We make sure we have nice objects around about ourselves. So, you know, we do a lot of kind things to ourselves, the kind of things that you would not do to somebody who you don't like. So I think some of the problem with us not liking ourselves or having difficulty with liking ourselves is not recognizing that we are actually showing ourselves kindness all the time. And again, if you look at what happens when somebody is doing kindnesses for you and you don't appreciate that, you know, you don't see it sometimes. You take it for granted. And so you don't feel any sense of, you know, warmth or reciprocity. And I think that dynamic happens internally as well. We're doing kind things for ourselves, but we're not recognizing, hey, this is me taking care of myself. Maybe we're just too distracted. Maybe we're just taking it for granted. But if you do that, you know, you buy your cup of coffee at Starbucks and just spend a moment saying, this is me being kind to myself. Yeah. You sit down to eat and you've got some food that you like in front of yourself and you say, this is me being kind to myself. You're walking across the road and you're just being careful to, you know, avoid bumping into other people and being run down, and you say, this is me being kind to myself. And then you start to recognize, hey, actually, I'm being kind to myself all the time. But I've been ignoring that, and what I've been doing is I've been focusing on the times when I've not been kind to myself. And that looms large in your mind, and you identify with that, and you think it's what you are, you think it's who you are, it becomes your self-identity. But it's a false perception of your self-identity. And I think we tend to have a lot of those negative thoughts towards ourselves because we're not appreciating the positive things that we're doing for ourselves. So once you start to recognize, hey, I'm showing myself kindness all the time, you don't feel the need to beat yourself up so much because you're recognizing the skillful in yourself. It's a form of self-mudita. You know, mudita is one of the Brahma Viharas, and it's often explained as feeling happy because somebody else is happy. And there are some of the commentaries that define it that way, but the earliest commentary that I know of defines it in terms of valuing the skillful. It's paying attention to and valuing the skillful that gives rise to happiness. So I think a lot of our lack of self-metta is actually a lack of self-mudita. We actually have skillful qualities, but we're not allowing ourselves to see them. And these skillful qualities are not just to do with how we relate to ourselves. But, you know, a lot of the time we're being kind to other people and we don't even recognize that. We just take it for granted. So when you start to recognize the positive in yourself, you don't feel the need to beat yourself up. Lots of questions. I'd like to go on though, so maybe we could keep these really quick. Could we just, I hate to say no. Come on, let's have one more question. What about you over here?
There. So, metta feels like such a critical part of my practice. And then, a question I grapple with is, in the holding space for others and wanting to be happy at peace, and identifying the just lack of separateness, but then also creating boundaries. Is part of healthy relationships too.
Mm.
And like, for example, in my family, there's a fair amount of addiction.
Mm.
And so I grapple with how to, and I feel angry sometimes for feeling my boundaries confronted from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been a stretching practice to figure out, and it continues and will always be maybe in this human, to figure out how to let someone go through their thing and acknowledge they're trying to figure it out and be happy, but also say, I'm not accepting this behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Any insight on how to do that?
I think anger can be a very good and very healthy thing. And I don't think anger and metta are opposed to each other. I think hatred and metta are opposed to each other. I think of anger just as being a strong desire to cut through the crap, a strong desire to... Well, it does a number of things. I mean, it can preserve your boundaries. It can communicate to somebody else that you just feel really strongly about things. And I think you can be angry from the basis of metta. As long as you don't get into, you know, attacking other people, because that's when you actually want other people to feel bad. You want to hurt them. And, you know, then, you know, there's no metta there. You've got the opposite of metta. But yeah, I would say, you know, be angry. Because sometimes it's necessary. Cool. Maybe we should, move on. There's, apart from the fact that loving kindness practice or kindness practice, emotional positivity generally provides a good basis for cultivating insight, because it allows us to give ourselves, you know, support while we're doing something that potentially is quite challenging. I think there's other reasons for doing loving kindness as well. I describe metta bhavana as being an unselfing On the selfing practice. On the selfing. And that's actually a translation of a Pali word. It was a word the Buddha used, ahankara, which means I-making, creating a sense of an I. And all unskillful emotions and all unskillful thoughts are involved in the creation of an I. All of the hindrances to meditation, I don't like this. I want this. I want to have this experience. You know, I'm worried about that thing that's going to happen. You know, self-doubt. I can't do this. I'm no good. Other people are better than I am at this. I can't do this. All of those kind of unskillful thoughts have an I at the center of them. And there's a relationship between you and something else. And you're either desiring that thing, or you're trying to push it away, or you're worried about it, or something like that. In metta practice, we let go of all of that. It's just, may I be happy. And the I there isn't particularly important. It's not a selfish, self-referential I. It's just, may this being here be well, maybe be happy. Sometimes I suggest to people that they talk to themselves in second person. You know, may you be well, may you be happy. So, you know, metta helps us to, like, you know, break away from our, you know, our individual preoccupations and recognize that there's a larger we here. You know, we are all going through the same kind of struggle. We all want to be happy. We all find that difficult. There's a really interesting study was done in 2001 by a researcher from the University of Texas, James Pennebaker, and somebody else who I think was just a graduate student at that time. And what they wanted to do was examine the phenomenon of suicidal poets, because poets are famous for killing themselves. It's a big thing, you know, in the poet community. Historically, poets are much more likely to end up committing suicide than people in any other literary genre. And they wondered whether there might be any, you know, indicators in the language that poets used that could predict whether they were likely to kill themselves or not kill themselves. So what they did was they created two different pools of poets who had killed themselves, poets who had not killed themselves. You can do this with poets. You probably couldn't find a large enough pool of, I don't know, basketball players or something like this. You could probably do it with rock stars. That would be interesting. Or who?
And they are poets.
They are, yes. Yeah, that's true. Poets who sing. So they tried to match them up as closely as possible. They would make sure that they paired a male suicidal poet with a male non-suicidal poet who was born in roughly the same place, roughly the same time period. And they did this computer analysis of the language that had been used. And they found something really striking. The poets who had killed themselves used the words I, me, and mine a lot. And they used them more and more as their lives went on. And the poets who had not killed themselves did not use the words I, me, and mine a lot. They used them a lot less. But they used words we, us, and ours a lot. And they used them increasingly as their careers went on as well. They compared the same time periods that the poets had written. So that's really interesting. Yeah, just there's, you know, some part of our conditioning which is no doubt of evolutionary origins but can be quite maladaptive. And it says that the way to be happy is to focus on yourself, you know, very, very intensively. And to some extent that can work. can imagine, you know, if you're stranded on a desert island or something like that, you have to be really, really concerned, you know, about yourself and, you know, how you're going to survive and maybe even be in competition with other people or something like that. But, you know, most of the time it's actually counterproductive. The more we focus on ourselves, the more isolated and the more unhappy we feel. So I see all Buddhist practice, essentially, as having this aim of unselfing. Even something as simple as when you're sitting in meditation and you get caught up in a thought and you let go of that thought and come back to your breathing again. That thought was almost invariably something to do with yourself, something you're worried about, something you're annoyed about, yeah, something that you want. And so we catch ourselves selfing in our thoughts, and we just come back, you know, to what is. And this brings us to the topic of anatta, or not self. You used to hear, I don't think you hear this so often these days, but you used to hear a lot of Buddhist teachers talking about the anatta doctrine. You find this in a lot of, you know, earlier books on Buddhism. Maybe you still find it, I don't know, the anatta doctrine, the non-self doctrine. And this was very often taken as being a teaching that the Buddha had made, that there is no self. It's often presented in earlier books on Buddhism as being, you know, a key insight of the Buddha's, that there is no self, and it's elevated to the level of a doctrine. But I'm not aware of anything in the Pali Canon that amounts to an anatta doctrine. And in fact, anatta doesn't mean no self. It means non-self or not self. And if you look at how the Buddha actually used the word, it was almost always in terms of this thing is not yourself. This thing that you take to be yourself is not you. So he does that with the five skandhas, this form, your feelings, your perceptions, your habits, even your consciousness. These things are not yourself. You can't define yourself by any of these things. He does it in terms of the six elements as well, which we're going to be exploring in more depth. So the six elements, if you're not sure what those are earth, which is everything solid and substantial in the body, everything in this human form that is solid matter. And there's water, which is everything that in this form, which is liquid or quasi-liquid. There's fire, which is energy. The Buddha defined it in terms of it's what allows, well, he didn't use the word metabolism, but he said it's what allows digestion, it's what allows for movement. There's air, which, you know, is flowing in and out of our bodies all the time, dissolving in our bloodstream. So that's our physical being. And the Buddha kept pointing out, and this is what we'll be exploring experientially in the practice, these things are not you. And then there's the fifth and sixth elements. There's space, which is the actual physical form, because you may think, well, okay, so there's all these elements in this human body, in this form, and they're not me, but the form itself is. So the Buddha encourages to see this form is not me. This is not mine. And there's our consciousness again, which is also in the skandhas. This is not me. This is not mine. I am not this. But the Buddha never said there's no self. In fact, he directly contradicted that at times. There was one time he was asked by somebody, is there no self? And he didn't actually contradict that person. he just kept quiet, didn't answer, and let that person go away. And he was asked afterwards, you know, why is it that you didn't answer? And he said, well, if it said there was a self, that person was going to misinterpret it. If I said there wasn't a self, that person was going to misinterpret it as well. And there was a philosophy around at the time of the Buddha, which he referred to as nihilism, which wasn't the, you know, what we tend to assume, you know, nihilism as we think it was, you know, bleak and, you know, lacking in hope or something like that. But it was the philosophical belief that there was no self and that there was no continuity after death. And the Buddha seemed to have a real horror of this. And it may be, well, it's quite explicit actually, the reason that he had this horror was because when people thought that there was no, there was nothing beyond death, it seemed that they often came to the conclusion that there was no point in being moral. So you could do anything what you wanted because there was no consequences. It's kind of interesting because a lot of us these days, even some of us who are Buddhist, don't have any firm belief in rebirth. You know, there's lots of atheists around who believe that when they die, that's it. But they also do feel very moral. So I'm curious about, you know, why the Buddha had that. And maybe it was just because the people who adopted that particular viewpoint tended to be very immoral at that time. Or maybe the Buddha was a bit like, you know, a lot of fundamentalist Christians these days. I mean, is that the first time the Buddha's ever been compared to a fundamentalist Christian? Well, just, you know, think about it. I mean, a lot of fundamentalist Christians, I mean, they have the belief that morality is something that comes from, you know, God, from belief in the Bible, in Jesus. And if you don't have that belief, then, you know, you're a wicked heathen who can do anything, you know, because you've got no fear about the consequences of your actions. So they're not right, because, you know, lots of us don't believe in God and yet see it as being very valuable, a very valuable thing to be moral, you know, to behave well, to treat other people with respect, and with kindness. But they don't see that things that way, and maybe the Buddha didn't either. Maybe he just didn't have any positive role models of people who were, you know, atheist or didn't believe in an afterlife and yet had a belief in morality. I don't know. It's very curious. So the Buddha kept making this statement that this is not you, you know, that is not you, this is not yourself. And he's encouraging us to let go of self-definitions. He didn't ever, and this, I suppose this is important to note, he didn't ever say, okay, you look at this and that thing that you identify with and you recognize as you're experiencing it, this is not me, this is not mine, I am not myself. He didn't say you do that and then say, oh yeah, and by the way, this is yourself. He regarded any sense of self-identification as being a problem. Because anything that you can point to in your experience and say, yeah, this is myself, is changing. And so you end up with some kind of anxiety because you're clinging, you're identifying, and then this thing is changing, and then you end up feeling undermined. So another thing that the Buddha said, which is more explicit in terms of there not being a self, was he said, there is no view you can have of the self which will not lead to suffering. Any view you have of the self is going to lead you to suffering. And he outlined a number of views, including the view, I have no self. And he saw that as being a cause of suffering. So he seemed to be saying, you're indefinable, which is maybe more, you know, understandable in some ways. However, you will sometimes hear me saying, you don't have a self. You hear lots of Buddhist teachers saying, you know, you don't have a self. And I think it's a very valid point. But I think how you have to interpret that is that we're saying you don't have the kind of self you think you are. That you don't have the kind of self you think you have. So what kind of self do we think we have? I mean, these are just deep-rooted assumptions that we have. We assume that there's some kind of essence, something that is essentially us, something that's, you know, unchanging over the course of our lives. So we assume that there's some kind of permanence there. We assume that there's separateness. There's a me in here, and there's a world out there. And there's a nice little quote from the English teacher, Alan Watts. He said, "We do not come into this world. We come out of it as leaves from a tree." That's quite beautiful. "As the ocean waves, the universe peoples." So he's using these as verbs. "As the ocean waves, the universe peoples. Every individual is an expression of the whole realm of nature, a unique action of the total universe. This fact is rarely, if ever, experienced by most individuals. Even those who know it to be true in theory do not sense or feel it, but continue to be aware of themselves as isolated egos inside bags of skin." So the six element practice very much focuses on these two things, our sense of permanence, our sense of separateness. And there's another thing that we think about ourselves, which I may have time to talk about today, I don't know. And that is that we are autonomous. That we have some kind of, well, we think of ourself as being conscious. I have this conscious self which makes decisions. It's responsible for what I do, which is a very, very questionable assumption. It's quite easy to question that with modern neuroscience and its tools and its ability to look into the mind as we're making decisions. Just to give you an example, well, two examples of this. There was a study, I think back in the 70s, by Benjamin Libet, who asked people to, at some random moment, do something. I think to tap their hand or something like that. And he monitored what happened in the brain. And their instruction was, as soon as you think of tapping your hand, do it. As soon as you make the conscious decision to tap your hand, you do it. And he found that just before people tapped their hand, there was a burst of activity in the brain, quite deep down. This was the decision being made. You're not aware of making these decisions. At some point, they erupt into consciousness. Then we become aware of them. And at that point, there's a little part of us says, "I did that." And that part of you is completely deluded. I describe it as being the inner plagiarist.
What inner?
Inner plagiarist.
Inner plagiarist.
Yeah, because it's taking responsibility, it's claiming responsibility for something that some other part of the brain has done.
But I was the first neuroscientist.
Yeah, I think he was, yeah. There's even more stunning evidence of this, because Libet didn't have access to very sophisticated tools back in the 70s, and now we have fMRI and we can look into the activities of the brain in a much more fine-grained level. And there was an American researcher working in Berlin who asked people to do the same experiment, and he watched their brains. And I think the choice was between either tapping your right hand or your left hand, and you did that at the moment you thought of it. Well, he could predict 6 seconds before you made the decision to tap your hand, which hand you were going to tap. It's quite astonishing, really. There's this layer of conscious awareness floating on top of our minds. and it's aware of stuff happening, and it thinks, I did that. Quite fascinating. So all of these beliefs are false. The belief in permanence, the belief in separateness, the belief in autonomy, that there's an autonomous, unitary self that's making decisions in a conscious way. The six element practice mostly focuses on the first two of those. So I think maybe we'll do a short sit again, and then maybe we can take a little break, stretch our legs, come back, do another meditation. So after our little break, we'll come back and we'll start to explore the six element practice. We'll do a reflection on the first four elements. So we'll do a little period of just sitting. So just being here. Just being with our experience as it arises. But you can drop a question in and just let this question linger. And the question is, where is myself? Where can you find this thing that you call yourself? If you think you've identified something that is yourself, ask yourself another question. Is this something that I have? I regard that I have this thing, I have this body, I have this awareness, whatever. Or is it something that I am? Because it can't be both at the same time. If you have a body, the body can't be you. It's something you have. So just apply that question to anything that you might be tempted to regard as yourself. So why don't we take a break for 20 minutes? It's now 12. Maybe we could have the break in silence. So welcome back. So we'll start with a guided period of reflection on the first four elements, just as a reminder. And you know, I'm going to talk you through the practice, so you don't need to remember this, but just so you have some foreshadowing. There's the earth element, which is everything that's solid in this human form. There's the water element, which is liquid. There's the fire element, which is energy and movement. And there's the air element, which is air. Actually, the Buddha didn't call it air, he called it wind. They didn't have a concept of air at that time, because they didn't know about things like gases. They only the only way you could know that air existed at that time was by feeling it moving across you. So they thought of it as wind rather than air. And I'm not going to say much before we actually do the practice, because I'll just, you know, drop in suggestions on the way. And then we'll break for lunch from 1 to 2. And then when you come back, I'll give you some of the background to the practice, both historically and in terms of the theory behind it. And then we'll do the full six-element practice. So let's start off just by, once again, settling into our meditation posture. And just arriving. I kind of like meditating in noisy places for a couple of reasons. One is that sound expands our sense of awareness. You can really feel the space around you by being aware of the sounds. And the other reason is that sounds are a very good opportunity for us to practice patience, just allowing things to happen. Acceptance, that's the word I'm looking for. You can't change the sound of that machinery. You can't make it stop. Can't make it quieter. You can't turn it into something else. So the kindest, most sane response is just to let it pass through the space of your awareness. And just seeing if you can bring those same qualities of openness and acceptance into your awareness of this body that's sitting here. And becoming more aware of the solidity of the body, the solid parts of the body. So there is a traditional list, but we're not going to go through it in a systematic way. You can be aware of things like there's hair on your head, on your body. You can know it's there, even if you can't feel it. There are nails on the fingers and on the toes. There are the teeth. These are all non-living parts of the body. You can feel the bones. Some of them you can feel quite directly. For example, where your sitting bones are pushing down into your seat. Perhaps the bones in the hands, if you have your hands resting on each other. You can feel the rib cage moving as you breathe. To a large extent, we're just knowing that the bones are there. We can kind of feel them. The bones in the feet and the legs, the hips, the pelvis, spine. The rib cage, shoulders and arms and hands. The bones of the skull, the jaw. There are even those tiny bones in your ear. There are the muscles covering the skeleton. You can feel those much more directly. You can feel the internal sensations of the muscles. You can feel the solid contact that they make with your seat, with the floor. Maybe your hands are resting on the solid mass of your thigh muscles. Maybe you can feel the arms resting against the ribcage. There's the skin covering the whole body. You can feel the contact that your skin is making with your clothing, with your waistband, and again with the seat, with the floor, any place where one part of your body is in contact with another. And then again, you can't feel most of these directly. You can be aware of the heart. It's beating away. Be aware of the lungs. And the other internal organs, like the brain, the spleen, liver, kidneys. You can just know that they're there. So this is what the Buddha called the internal earth element. It's what we cling to as ourselves. And what we're going to do now is reflect on where that's come from and where it's going. So I invite you to go right back to the very beginning. You're contemplating this human body. But at one point, there wasn't a human body. There wasn't even a you. There was a point where you were conceived. A cell from your father, which was part of your father. And a cell from your mother, which was part of her, met. You might imagine that. Two cells fusing. Do you have any sense that this was you? Because all of that matter came from two other bodies. And it's so different from you. No consciousness, no awareness. It's just living matter borrowed from two bodies. And then it grows. You can imagine this little fertilized ovum absorbing nutrients from your mother's body and growing, dividing, developing. Now maybe we can imagine ourselves as a fetus, just being aware that all of the matter that went into creating the body of that fetus came from outside, they were all borrowed from your mother's body and ultimately from food, from fields, from crops, probably animals that she ate. And then after birth, you started consuming more directly, the body's still growing, becoming larger. But all of the solid matter going into that body, coming from outside. So just taking that on board. And fast forwarding in our imaginations, that is what led to this body right here. This body which you constantly have to feed. So maybe just recollecting some of the food you've eaten recently. I think of the bread I had this morning, which just a little time ago was grain growing in a field. And before that, it was carbon dioxide, it was minerals in the soil. So this is where the body comes from. There's not a single atom in this body that you have created. So as you're aware of the solidity of this human form, you can know that it's all borrowed. It's not you, it's not yours, it's not who you are, it doesn't define you. Let's just become aware of where this earth element, this internal earth element, is going. Right now, as you're sitting here, you're breathing out. Your breath contains carbon dioxide. That carbon dioxide, just moments before, was solid matter in your body. So just be aware that as you're sitting here breathing, your body is burning up. You're shedding skin cells around your body as a cloud of skin cells that have fallen off. This is all what's happening. The skin cells go back into the environment, get broken down, recycled. You're losing hairs, leaving a little trail of them everywhere you go. You shave some of those hairs off and wash them down the sink. You've probably been to the bathroom this morning. And if you defecated, that wasn't just all undigested food. A lot of it was cells from your body, breakdown products of dead cells excreted into the gut. So not only is the solid matter that we're aware of right now being borrowed from the outside world, it's in the process right now of returning to the outside world. And knowing this, just return now to an awareness of your physical experience in the here and now. Just knowing in the background of your awareness that this body you're observing is not separate, not static. It's soil and grass and fields and trees and plants and animals. It's not separate. It's not stable. It's not static. It's a flow. Even your bones are constantly dissolving and being rebuilt. And so observing this body and knowing it as a flow, you can say to yourself the words, "This is not me. This is not mine. I am not this. This is not me. This is not mine. I am not this." So now we can contemplate the water element. Again, beginning by being aware of anything liquid or quasi-liquid in the body. So you'll notice the saliva in your mouth. You can maybe feel the tears in your eyes as you blink from time to time. It's kind of warm in here, so you're probably experiencing a little sweatiness. You can feel your heart beating and your pulse in various parts of the body. And this is a reminder of blood flowing. You might feel the pressure of liquid in your bladder. You might be able to feel mucus in your nasal passages or in the back of your throat. And you can know that every tissue in your body is saturated with water. Every cell in your body is full of water. surrounded by water, bathed in it. More than anything else, you're a creature of water. It composes most of your physical body. The water in your joints, synovial fluid. There's liquid surrounding your brain and your spinal cord. There's various other fluids, lymph, bile. Sometimes you'll feel a little gurgling from within. So this is the internal water element. And again, we just contemplate where did this come from? You might even be feeling a little thirsty at the moment, or maybe you were thirsty earlier. The water element passes through us much more quickly, even than the earth element. So just think of what you've been drinking recently, today and the last few days. Cups of tea or coffee you've had, glasses of water, fruit juice, moist foods. And where did all that water come from? From the soil, from rivers, from lakes, from the oceans. So this is what's flowing through your body right now. This is what is saturating every cell in your body. Borrowed oceans, clouds, rivers. And just being aware that this water element is not something you can hold on to. It's in a sense borrowed, but it's just passing through. So that sweatiness you can feel, perhaps, is water leaving the body. Notice how your out-breaths are moist and heavy in comparison to the cooler, lighter air you're breathing in. With every out-breath, you're losing water from the body. You've almost certainly been to the bathroom today. And that's another way that water passes through us. Perhaps the most obvious one. So again, just returning to the a moment by moment awareness of the body, of any hint, trace, or direct perception of water in the body, but aware that it's flowing through us like a river. It's like we are the riverbanks and the water is flowing through. And as the water passes by, we can say, this is not me. This is not mine. I am not this. And then there's the fire element. So feel the warmth of your body. Notice the movements of your breathing and any other movements in the body. The beating of your heart. This is all energy, metabolism. And again, we're back to asking, where does this energy come from? Something we know the answer to. It's been in all the food we've eaten, along with the matter and the water in that food. There was stored energy. That energy comes from the growth of plants, animals too, if you eat animals. Ultimately, it all comes from the sun. Plants are nature's way of capturing energy from the sun. We animals live on recycled sunlight. So all this energy that you can feel, all this warmth, all this movement, it's all there because you have borrowed energy from the outside world. And it too is flowing through you. You can't hold on to it. You're alive because of this flow of energy. Warmth is leaving your body, radiating out, being absorbed by your seat, warming the air around you. And once again, just back to the direct experience of sitting here, being aware of heat, movement, and knowing that this is not something static, but it's a river of energy flowing through this human form from the world back into the world again. And we can observe of this river, the world flowing into itself. This is not me. This is not mine. I am not this. Finally, the last of the physical elements is air. And as soon as you become aware of the air in your body, you become aware that it's flowing in and out. It's passing through you much more quickly than any of the other elements. So quickly that you're immediately aware that there is a kind of a river of air flowing through this body. Of course, it's not just entering and leaving the lungs, but it's dissolving into and filling the entire body. So observing the flow of the breathing, observing perhaps even the whole body breathing, paying attention to sensations throughout the body as you're breathing in and as you're breathing out. And just reminding yourself, this is not me. This is not mine. I am not this. What is it you're breathing in? The oxygen that's sustaining you was produced in the oceans by plankton, by forests across the globe, by grasses and bushes and mosses and lichens and algae. So this is what you're breathing in, and this is what you're giving back to. And so being more aware now of the world around you, the sirens of perfect timing, just reminding us again of the physical reality of the outside world. Physical presence of other beings. Just allowing ourselves to rest in our physical presence here. Gently reacclimating to being in this space. And then when you feel ready, just letting the eyes open. Just realizing that we're sitting here and there's all this stuff flowing through us. We're not equipped perceptually to recognize the flow, so we have to use our imagination. But there's all this stuff flowing through us, that's soil and it's plants and it's animals and it's sunlight and it's rivers and it's lakes and it's rain, and it's all flowing through us. But you're just sitting here just being aware of everybody else. Just recognize it's exactly the same stuff flowing through them. You see these human forms around you, and they're made of exactly the same stuff, all flowing through them, the same stuff that's flowing through you. Different form, same stuff. It's a little bit mind-blowing. I feel really close to you all. It's like bits of the rainforest that are flowing through me can almost like say hi to the bits of the rainforest that are flowing through you. Anyway, let's break for lunch. You can go and ingest some more elements.
Recycle,
yeah.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.